Welcome everyone to Art of Advisory. My name is Hector Garcia from Quick Bookkeeping, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kirk Bowman. Hey, Kirk, how are you today?
What's going on, Hector? How are things in Miami?
Everything's great in Miami. How are things in Texas?
It's getting hot, brother. It's getting hot.
That is a good thing. I think I like the whole pool mentality, right? When at any point in time you can say, I think I'll go to the pool today. There's something about that just makes life better. Anyway, so on the last episode, we talked about scoping and we actually went deeper into sort of the fear of the unknowns and scoping and pricing the unknowns. And we talked a lot about the risks behind pricing the big unknowns wrong and maybe where that's maybe not so much risk, but an opportunity. So I would like to take the approach, Kirk, that we are mostly looking at the risk of the unknowns of an engagement as the biggest opportunity, not just for us to make money by pricing it accordingly, but for us to nail it right in the head on what is it that the client wants in the long run. So I would like to focus a lot more around that. So Kirk, with that, I'll ask you, what do you think is the most important piece of the process of scoping a job or scoping a project?
So the most important piece, I may sound like a broken record, is to understand value from the customer's perspective. Because until you know what the outcome is that they're seeking, then the scoping is irrelevant. Now, I would say once you do have that outcome, and so I'm just simply going to repeat that as kind of a foundational principle and move on, because we talked a lot about that on the previous episode. But once you have that result in mind, to a certain degree, how you achieve that result should not concern the customer. Now, customers a lot of times insert themselves into the scope and how you achieve the result quite by training because of hourly billing. When they have worked with other people in hourly billing focuses on inputs, which is focusing on the scope. And so they've been trained by not just accountants and bookkeepers, but lawyers, software, advertising, marketing, et cetera, to focus on what goes in, you know, because surely by focusing on what goes in, you'll get what you want to come out. Not necessarily. I think you need to focus on the outcome and not be so concerned with, you know, what is the phrase, means does or does not justify the ends. What we want to focus on with the customer is the ends and leave the means to us because we're the professional. And just because I might have gotten to an outcome one way with one customer, I might approach it another way with another customer, right? I mean, something as simple as whether a business is an S corp or a C corp could determine how I approach a certain tax saving strategy. It could determine how I approach setting up a retirement plan for employees. It could determine how we want to set up our chart of accounts, et cetera. There's so many things that can influence, and it applies not just to accounting, but bookkeeping and other things. So my first comment was focus on the result with the customer. My second is don't get too down in the weeds with a customer on the scope because really it should not concern them too much. Now, third, you still need to define scope because part of any fixed price is a fixed scope. There is some point where there's going to be a line that once you cross it, that was not in the original intent, the original focus of the engagement. And so once that happens, you have to determine how to achieve that. But those would be my first three comments. Focus on the end. Second, means shouldn't really be that particular to the customer. And third, there is a line that once you cross it, you'll need to say something. And by the way, who determines when something is out of scope? The person who wrote the scope. And who should write the scope? The professional. So those would be my first three comments.
All right. So the overall premise of what you're saying is that writing down that scope and setting up that, let's call it schedule of results of the scope and limitations of what we will do and what we won't do and in some cases, how we will do it. And again, you said that the how is shouldn't be that important, but there are two types of hows, in my opinion. There is what I call the back office hows and the client facing hows. And those two could have different effects on the client. So there are some hows, exactly what you're saying, you know, how we get there shouldn't matter to the customer if they don't see it, right? But then if how you get there is something that they see, you almost have to set the expectation up front of what that how will look like, so they don't get the perception that you're doing it wrong, and then they'll hang on to that in order to do a scope breach. So I'll give you an example. So if you explicitly tell a client that you're gonna be working on their file on Tuesdays between 9 and 12, just give you an example, and the client can actually observe you working on that file, whether it's you're doing something remotely or you're doing it physically on site, and you happen to do it on different times than what you promised, this is what I call the visible how of the scope, the client could use that breach of scope from your part to hang on to then actually purposely breach another piece of it, which is asking you to do other things that are not in the contract. So, or maybe contract is the wrong word to use because we're not lawyers. We don't really write contracts, but you know, the scope document or the engagement document or the fixed price agreement. And maybe I'll have you comment on, you know, what do you like to call those documents, because that could add some context to it. But I think it is important to understand with your client if there are visible hows that are part of the scope, or if they're not visible hows that are part of the scope. So the least visible hows or the visible tasks that they see, the more weight they'll put on the end result, correct? Because there are essentially two ways to get hired by a client in the accounting context. You can get hired by what I call is a pair of hands. So I'm there to physically do a task in front of the client, physically get instructions from the client on how to do something, which is a little bit, I don't want to say it's not so much anti-professional, but it's not so much the spirit of why most professionals get hired. And then there's the other piece, which is, hey, the client will trust you to achieve a result. It will trust you that you would do things ethically, that you would do things legally, all that stuff. And then at the end, you manage how you process that data or how you do that work, and you give the client the end result. So if you approach any project by telling the client what you're going to do, and that's what you make explicit, versus what you're going to achieve or what you're going to give or what is going to be the result, there's much more risk on, you know, having a scope creep if you expose the process to the client, or at least delineate the process to the client, because any changes, and that's life, right? We have changes. We have things that we're not expecting for them to happen. Any changes that happen through any visible piece of the process, and that's the only part that you made explicit, is going to give you a much more higher probability that there could be a scope creep, or the client can use it as an agent to create the scope creep. Because some customers, you know, not maliciously, but they want more out of you. They want you to do more stuff than what you want to do usually, or what you negotiate. They want to get as much stuff for you as stuff out of you as possible for what they're paying. So they're always going to look for ways to, and again, not they're not all like that, but a lot of them are like that, way to extract more work out of you if it's to their benefit without having to pay more. So I think that the lesson here is there are two types of hows, right? The process and procedure, how you do the work. Some of them are visible to the client, some are not visible to the client. And you want to give it some deep thought in terms of, is the client expecting to see them or to have to look at them in writing or see a checklist or follow along as you do it, or is the client more waiting for you to deliver a result at the end? I don't know, in the database design and software development business, Kirk, and you can attest to that, if you kind of run into the same situations, right? Because I mean, most people don't know how to program, so it'll be very difficult for them to look at the code and say, aha, you skipped the line there, right? But in accounting, it's a little bit different, because in accounting, a lot of the stuff that we do is very visible. Like, they physically see us grab the documents. They physically see us scan the documents. So I don't know if there's a big difference, but I would love to hear your take around this contrast between the visible piece of the scope and the invisible piece of the scope.
As I'm listening to you, I think I'm going to sound like a broken record again, but I think it really boils down to how you approach business with a customer. I think if you approach it on an hourly basis, you're going to get stuck in the weeds. If you approach it on a value basis, you're not going to be as likely to get stuck in the weeds. And if a customer does try to go into the weeds, and by the way, the weeds in this analogy would be how you're going to do it, the exact details of the scope, it's easier to redirect them back to this is the result we're achieving. Now, if a customer has a question about how a particular step will impact that result, you can certainly answer it. I'm not saying that you just, every time a customer asks a question about scope, that you just deflect it. But for example, in the software world, sometimes we can get tied down in just little things like, okay, I want the font to be, you know, 14 point instead of 12, and I want this button to be blue instead of green. And that kind of stuff creates no extra value for anybody, and it totally gets you off track. And once you start going down that rabbit hole on those little bitty things, it just, you know, once you do it once, and this is why I said the third point that I wanted to make was knowing where that line is and not cross it. Once you cross that line and you don't, you know, kind of stop and say, hey, this is out of scope, how should we handle this? Once you cross that line, it makes it easier to cross it again and again and again. So knowing where that is. I also want to comment on something you said, and it may have just been a, you know, kind of I couldn't tell whether you were serious or not, but in this day and age, customers don't see you scan the documents and all that stuff that much, right? I mean, don't most accountants work remotely at this point or not?
Not necessarily the case. I mean, there's tons. We'll leave it up to our audience to let us know. You know, so you can certainly put comments in the chat and in the Facebook live video, let us know. But I think there's still a mixture. I think there's still folks that only work from home and from their office. And there are type of engagements where we physically go on site. And not most people don't pay professionals to scan documents. So I will take that back from the perspective is that that's our job. But I was just trying to illustrate, you know, the type of things that we do with our hands and with physical presence that the client can observe. I mean, it could be something else. It could be, you know, archiving documents. But I would say that there's still a big group of people that work on site or that do a hybrid between, you know, one time on site a month and the, you know, four times remote and that sort of thing. So there is some aspects of working in person where the clients do observe your work.
Well, and when clients are observing your work, I think it's in those situations where if you haven't set up the relationship with the customer as one of business professional, consultant to business owner, if it's set up as a pair of hands and you kind of started down explaining, you know, the different ways you can work with a customer, if you haven't set it up that way from the beginning, then that's when, again, things can go awry. It's interesting as we're talking about scope, it's reinforcing to me how much of it really goes back to the initial conversations you have with the customer and how you initially start working with them. So much of this idea of scope and how you handle it goes back to how you position yourself and how you interact with the customer initially. Mahan Khalsa from his book, Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play, says how you sell should be an example of how you serve or how you solve. And again, this is the case. Now, I do think at some point during the session, we want to get into, okay, when that line has been crossed, how do you handle it? And so I think we both have some things to say there, but I guess is so much of it just boils down to what you do ahead of time. It's just like building a house, right? If you hire the right architect, if you draw the right blueprint, if you have a good site survey, if all the things that are necessary to plan in advance are done well, it will make things go smoother. You know, to use another analogy, measure twice, cut once.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're right. And I want to dive into that topic in particular. So let's get into how we handle breaches of scope. Okay. So the general premise is we are going to do a quote unquote, a really good job at value conversation, understanding what the client values the most. If the client expresses that value to you, it wouldn't be numerical, but it would be via priorities, and we'll get into options. And I think, Kirk, you know, your seven ways to approach, there's your seven options approach. It's probably one of the most effective ways to understand what the client values. And in essence, if we can dig deep enough where the client wants a lot of value from us, we tend to do more work and we tend to run much less into scope creep, right? So, but the challenge is on the smaller clients, because the scope problem usually, it's funny, the scope problem happens with your largest clients and with your smallest client. Most of the ones in the middle and the average tend to average out. Like, you know, some don't require that much and some require a lot, but it's the really small clients or the small engagements that you're trying to satisfy a small budget and try to limit the amount of resources you involve in that project, the ones that become just sort of the biggest worry about scope creep. And then the largest ones, I think it's just in nature, because they're so large, you tend to have a deeper relationship with the client. And the deeper relationship you have with the client, the easier it is, I guess, to inadvertently do scope creep in both sides. You know, the professional could do scope creep by just assuming the client would be okay with something, right? And not verify and just move forward. Or the client can go to scope creep, assuming that we have such a good relationship that I think it's just natural that I ask them to take care of this for me. So it is those larger, really larger scope clients that will have a much riskier scope creep. And it's the really small ones in which we designed it that way because we're trying to purposefully take a smaller client because we're trying to help them or we're trying to fit a budget, but we're always sort of tiptoeing around doing extra work just because there isn't enough budget to handle doing all that work and for us to invest the resources around it. So as a general premise, as Kirk said, if you do a good enough job at digging for value, having a value conversation, understanding what the client wants, what the priorities are, you will tend to have a larger project with a larger scope, and you would be less hesitant towards doing something that maybe is a small scope. But when we don't take our time doing a deep discovery engagement, and I think, Kirk, that's probably down the path you want to go into, a deep discovery engagement, and we take the job just because we're trying to transact, we're trying to move forward, we're saying, yes, sir, we'll do your tax return, yes, sir, and we move forward, that's when we run into a situation where, you know, everything is so implicit that it's just assumed, like both parties assume that we're supposed to do something or not supposed to do something as part of the engagement. So as you said, and I would agree with 100%, the minute there's a scope creep, we need to deal with it immediately. I think that a lot of times, especially when it's a new client, and I run into this situation a lot, when it's a brand new client, it's actually easier to fix the problem than to call the client and explain what the problem is, which sounds like a non-problem because it only took 3 minutes to fix. But the problem is that the minute you let that go, then it becomes a slippery slope. And I don't know if that's ever happened to you, Kirk, where there's a clear breach in scope, but it's faster to fix than to call the client and explain why it's a breach in scope. So I think that's the first thing, is just build up the courage to automatically bring it out into the open. And there's nothing wrong with doing it, fixing it as a courtesy, but we almost have to do the extra work and document it and let the clients know, hey, I took care of this because it was a scope creep. Or actually never use that word, by the way, scope creep is something that doesn't go well with clients. But you can say, look, this is beyond the scope. I took care of it as a courtesy, but for the next time, here's a set of instructions on how you have to do it correctly in order for us not to run into this situation, because I think it's a huge slippery slope. So what do you think about that? Like running into that first scope creep moment that it only takes 5 minutes to fix versus calling the client to explain, and how that becomes the actual scope creep conversation.
Well, I think you're exactly correct. As I mentioned previously, the first time that line is quote crossed, you have to decide how you're going to address it. And as you alluded, one way to address it is to simply include it. Maybe you make a decision, hey, I just want to include this because I want to serve the customer well, or this is something that I should have thought of, and so I'm going to go ahead and include it. You can do that, but tell the customer you're doing it. And it could be as simple as over a phone call or via email saying, hey, this came up. Technically, it's out of scope. However, I'm going to include it and then state the reason. But don't just give the customer a gift. Let them know you gave them a gift. I mean, I think about it at Christmas, right? If I buy perfume for my wife, I just don't go set it on the counter in our bathroom and hope she'll, you know, use it. I wrap it up. I give it to her. I let her know that she got a gift. If for no other reason, then she needs to know she got it. Because how's she going to be able to appreciate that gift? How's she going to be able to know that I thought about her and that I cared about her unless I tell her? And the same thing applies with a customer. You need to let them know you were thinking about them and taking care of them, even if you decide to include it. Now, I would say that's probably the exception, not the rule. Probably what the rule is that the customer has either asked for something, or simply assumed that something is included and it's not. And so at that time, you want to use a change request. Now, we can talk more about the differences between a change request and a change order, but for now, I just want to define it. We think the term is important because you cannot order the customer to do anything. They can simply make a request, or you can make a request. That's really how it's going to go. You're not going to order the customer to make a change. You're going to request that the customer make a change. And so if there is something that is out of scope, you need to document it. You need to put it into writing. What is the new scope? And how's that going to affect the price, the schedule, et cetera, and get the customer to sign off on it and approve it. What I find, it's very easy if I tell the customer in advance. In other words, as part of the sales process, I educate them on how we handle changes. I'll say, look, we give you a fixed price for a fixed scope of work. If something comes up that is out of scope, I'm going to give you a change request with the new scope and the new price in writing, and then you can approve or not. If you've set that up, again, I go back to how you handle things from the beginning. So much of that can help you avoid issues once you get into the project. But you give them a change request and they simply get to approve it or reject it. Part of what that does is it helps the customer feel like they have control, right? Now, still, you have to have the courage, you know, you have to face your fear of, you know, saying to the customer, hey, this is out of scope. But bottom line, just saying, hey, we crossed the line. Here's what we need to do. Here's how we're going to handle it.
And that's, I think that's the key right there. I think you nailed it in the head. And that probably has been what has even caused me to get this wrong during the process. I think that in that initial conversation, you have to set the premise that there is a formal process to handling scope creep. I think it is probably the most indicative issue that all of us have, or a lot of us have, is that we know we must, like most people will say, we know we have to tell the client there's a problem. We know we have to tell the client there's a scope creep. We know we have to tell the client it will cost more money. I think everyone would agree that we know that. As a general premise, we know that. But the problem is how to go about having that conversation is what becomes the most difficult piece. And I think that a lot of us, including me, I fear having that conversation out of, you know, just sheer customer service. It's like, is the client going to be turned off by me because I'm making a big deal out of something small? In many cases, it is something small. But it's not that one small thing. It's a combination of the 100 small things that happen that it's what makes the project go sour. So I think you nailed it in the head, Kirk. The key is to set the expectation that there is a formal process to communicating change orders, changes in scope, so the client is expecting for you to have that conversation. And I think you almost have to say that, hey, in 100% of my engagements, we've had changes in scope. It is natural. Like we're only spending an hour to get to know each other, and you're handing me the reins of your financial information. So we are within an hour. You watch one of my videos, you got referral of one of my clients. we're spending an hour or two, and all of a sudden you're trusting me with all your financial information, and we expect to somehow magically know exactly what this relationship's going to look like for the next 3 years. So it's almost like nonsensical to not think that there is going to be a change in scope. So I think it almost behooves us to kind of acknowledge that up front, you know, look at the client in the eye and say, hey, this is normal. Don't worry about it. We go through this. This is totally okay. And I guess not be afraid that the client will judge you negatively for that. Because if anything, you're being the most human any other provider has ever been. I think most professional providers, we are just so obsessed with having the right answers and saying the right thing and saying the perfect thing. So the client reveres us and respects us. And maybe we're afraid to say, hey, you could make a mistake in telling me what you need. I could have made a mistake in understanding what you need. Our relationship long-term is probably more valuable than one little piece of scope creep. Let's design a process to handle those. So you talked about the change order. Is there a particular process in place? Is there an email or a document that you give beforehand? What does that look like in your world?
So first of all, just to reiterate, we prefer the term change request. And by the way, it's very easy to slip back and use the old term change order because, you know, we've been using that for decades and our colleagues use it all the time. So learning to change our language takes time, and I still slip up occasionally, but we do prefer the term change request. And I try to make sure I use that both in writing and in conversation whenever I'm talking with a customer about changes. Change request, it's actually fairly simple. You know, and I used to use a more formal document. I still have a standard format, but I guess it depends on the customer. The longer I've worked with customers, I find just really what's essential on it is to say something like, hey, you know, obviously you identify the customer, the project, you say, hey, here's the change that comes up. Here's what the scope looks like. Here's the price for it. And you have a place for them to sign. You could also include things, and you should, like, you know, if this change is going to impact the timeline, if it's going, you know, obviously you've already stated if it's going to impact the price, if there is a price. By the way, I should mention sometimes there could be a change that doesn't impact price. And this, I really need to go back to the triangle of truth. This is a concept that you'll find in most project management books. I like the way my friend Ed Kless describes it. You think about an equilateral triangle. An equilateral triangle has three perfect angles, right? There's 180 degrees in a triangle, and so it's three 60-degree angles, so that each corner of the triangle is equal to the other two. You've got three sides, and those three sides of the triangle, one of those will be resources, one of those will be timing, and then one of those will be scope. And anytime one of those three sides changes, gets shorter or longer, it changes the angles. And so whenever you adjust one of those, you have to adjust the other two so that you're constantly trying to maintain that equilateral triangle. Well, you could have a change that impacts one or two of those sides, but doesn't change the price. For example, you and the customer may agree to extend the timeline of a project because it's necessary, but it's not going to change the price for some reason. So I just make the point, you can have a change request that, you know, doesn't necessarily have a change in time, I mean, a change in price. Now, most of the time we are concerned with changes in price, right? Because we want to make sure that we're being financially responsible. And also we want to make sure that we're doing what's necessary to complete the project. And I would add, this is another reason that you want to make sure that you're completing projects on time, or that you're helping, I don't want to say push, but facilitate, encourage, you know, support the customer to complete the project, because a customer cannot fully realize the value from an engagement with you until the project's complete. In fact, a lot of times they don't start realizing any value from it until it's complete. And while customers, on one hand, they make changes because sometimes literally something in the business can change in the middle of a project, or sometimes they change their thinking about something, or sometimes they think of something new, or they remember something that they didn't mention. There are all kinds of reasons why changes come up. But the bottom line is most changes will affect getting to the result in one way or another. They're either going to increase the cost, they're going to increase the timeline, it's going to require more of this, less of that, et cetera. Well, we need to make sure that we're helping customers get to the end result so they can get the value. And so one of the reasons we need to be able to say, hey, something's out of scope is so the customer can actually realize the value from the project. I see it so much in software, customers keep adding features or adding requests and things. And so one of the things we've done is we create a wish list. So not only do we use change requests for changes that need to be approved because they have to be done in the project, but if it doesn't have to be done, we'll put it on a wish list. In fact, sometimes I'll ask the customer if we want to put it on a wish list. Sometimes I'll just say, you know what, we need to add that to the wish list. And again, I try to early in the project, you know, help the customer understand. Another way that we're going to use scope and try to help manage it is we're going to keep a list of those things that come up. And one of the things that's almost magical is once you have addressed using the wish list for changes once or twice, it becomes very easy to go to the customer and say, hey, that's probably going to get us off track. That's too much to add right now. Let's put that on the wish list and come back to it. And most customers, you'll get a feel for how important a change is just when you do that. So that's another tech. I hate to call it a technique, but it's another way to help keep the customer on focus because ultimately we have to facilitate them getting to the end result.
All right, hold on. I got to unpack this. You said so many things that is important to talk about. So you talked about the triangle of truth at first. So I Googled it real quick and I pulled up the triangle of truth. And actually, I think it's an awesome one, by the way. The triangle of truth is basically a physical triangle that has three points. One of it is your truth. One of it is my truth, or, you know, the professional's truth, the client's truth. And then there's the higher truth, right? And anytime we get into
this... Hold on, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm not sure what you Googled, but it's not the same triangle I was referring to.
I'll break it down. So there's the triangle of quality in project management that has the three spokes.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Which is scope, cost, and time, okay? But you call the triangle of truth, which actually led me to Google it, and actually that's actually a pretty cool one too. So I'll start with the triangle of truth for a second. So in any situation, there's going to be what I perceive to be the truth, what my customer perceives to be the truth, and then essentially what the higher truth is, right? So my perception, their perception, and the objective perception. At any point in time that we run into a situation that there is a cross in scope, I think almost always the client will disagree, right? The professional will say, yes, there's a scope. The client says, no. There's no scope creep. You know, this is part of it. This is right. Because when does the client actually want to pay more? Right. I mean, unless you actually wrote it down on the paper on the fixed price document that says we will not file your tax return. And then they come back and say, I want you to do my tax return. Normally that's okay. Cause you actually explicitly said you wouldn't. So that would be okay. That's technically not scope creep, but a crossing scope creep or a change request is when something that was explicitly discussed that this is not part of what we do, it's something the client now expects you to do, or you must do it in order to move forward. And that's kind of such an interesting piece of it, right? So at any point in time that you run into a discussion with the client around, you know, who's supposed to do what, almost always you're running into that situation. And this is a situation, nothing to do with accounting or project management or advisory or consulting. This is just life. In any point in time, you know, two people are discussing and trying to come up with an agreement. There's the perception that I have, the perception that they have, and the objective perception. So obviously the art of negotiation is finding a middle ground between them so we can have an even unilateral triangle. So that will create some harmony. Now, moving on to the other triangle you're talking about, the project management triangle, this is a scope, time, and cost. And basically all it says is, listen, if you were to increase the amount of scope that you want, the amount of resources I need to add, the amount of features we're going to add to this software, the amount of work and tasks and responsibilities that I'm taking, you know, we are going to now make this, we're going to offset this triangle, and now it's no longer going to be unilateral, I guess, or the same size for all the three vertebrates. I forget. What do you call that in geometry? What do you call each segments, right? So if you want every segment of the triangle to be in harmony and you want the most amount of quality or the most amount of output, you want to maximize the size of that triangle. The minute that you offset one of those spokes, right, you add more features without adding more time to do them in, or you add those features without adding more price, you know, paying for it, you're not going to get a balanced approach. So maybe we can get all the work you want done at the same price, but it's going to take us much longer to do it, right? That's one option. Or you can say, yes, I can get all the extra stuff done you want and around the same time, but you have to pay more. This is the balance of the triangle. Or, you know, maybe, you know, or maybe you're okay with paying what you're paying in the time that you're doing it and staying within the scope, which is pretty much what we want to achieve in the long run. So I just wanted, because I saw the two triangles and I was like looking at both, and I think both are pretty great when you look at them that way. So the other piece that you were talking about is the actual communication of that, okay? And that communication can happen in multiple, I guess, multiple approaches. And one of them that you mentioned was a wish list. So I would love to understand how I can actually take this concept of a wish list, which is something that maybe you see more in like the software development world. And we see it as, I'm a QuickBooks consultant and I have a huge wish list of what I want QuickBooks to do. And then they always, every year they have new things that they add, and they probably add one or two things from a wish list. So they almost programmed me to think that, hey, you can request all these things, but you're only going to get two or three out of them, because that is, you know, how we prioritize. That's how we use our limited resources. So I would love to understand, or maybe adapt this concept of a wish list into the accounting profession. And I can't think of a specific thing right now, but maybe we can brainstorm through it, Kirk. So let's just think of a typical example. Okay, so let's now think of a typical example. So somebody comes to you and says, hey, I want you to do my monthly bookkeeping. Okay. And by the way, that is as broad as it is. I mean, the most broad thing that exists in our profession is when someone says, I want you to do my bookkeeping. And it's super broad. In many cases, it's very low value from the client's perspective before you start talking about it. And from a professional perspective, it is the most important thing. Like almost everything people want us to do, present financial statements, give them custom reports, create budgets, prepare a tax return, prepare a special report for the insurance company, for work in progress report, discover what inventory it's missing, you know, what customers make us the most money, which ones not, which segment of our organization is growing, which is not. All of these extremely valuable uses of the accounting data, it's going to be wrong if the bookkeeping is wrong. So all the stuff the clients value, which is what we do with the numbers, is completely dependent on how we arrive or put together those numbers, which is that proverbial monthly bookkeeping service. So when a client hires you, a customer hires you to say, hey, let's do my monthly bookkeeping, and you put together a scope document, right? And that scope document says, we're going to take all the data from the banks and we're going to transcribe it into QuickBooks, and we're going to take all the receipts and we're going to transcribe them into QuickBooks, and we're going to ask you, you know, what every expense is so we can put it in the right category. And then at the end, we give them the report and they come back and tell you, well, how do I know which projects made me the most money? And then you come back and say, well, I can't give you that information. And the client says, wait a second, I thought that's what bookkeeping was for. You're like, well, in order for me to know that, I would have to have recorded every single project to every single expense, so then we can give you that piece of dimension. And the client goes, okay, sure, go ahead and do it. And you're like, oh, wait a second, okay, we arrived to scope creep, right? I would say that's a typical scope creep that we have, okay? So let's start with that, Kirk. How do we take that scenario, or knowing that that's a typical scenario for us, and turn this concept of a wish list into maybe a proactive system in which we don't run into that situation, or maybe turn that into maybe an opportunity to charge the client more or do more in-depth work?
So describe the situation for me again. I want to make sure I understand. What is the situation for which you're wanting to essentially role play creating a wish list?
That's perfect. So the typical scenario, most common scenario, is we get hired to do quote unquote bookkeeping. And then during the initial conversation, we discover typically technical scope, right? How many bank statements, how many credit cards, all that stuff. And maybe we didn't ask, you know, hey, would you like to know which segment of your business or which client makes you the most money? We didn't ask that because if we would ask, we would have known up front. And then in the middle of the job, maybe 2-3 months later, the client's asking us to give them customized reports that give them more information that essentially the inputs that we entered. We missed the opportunity to enter inputs like the specific project of each job. And now the client wants us to give them special reports that gives that, but we can't do it. So the client's not satisfied with the result. And if they want us to now give them that result, we have to go back and we have to re-enter specific pieces of data that we didn't capture because we didn't know the client wanted it, like specific project information per expenses. And that's clearly scope creep, right? So how would we use the wish list system for something like that?
Okay. So that's kind of a unique, it's probably a good use case because it doesn't fit how I would typically use it, but let's just walk through it. But the first thing that comes to mind is this sounds more like something that should have come up in discovery. Okay. So, and let me kind of clarify it. This is not necessarily simply, hey, I'd like additional report, right? This is, hey, I'd like, essentially how this request comes across is, hey, I need this report. And what you realize is when they request the report, there's initial data that should have been entered from the get-go, right? So this is a bigger issue than just saying, hey, I want to be able to view a report that the data already exists, right? Would you acknowledge that distinction here?
That's absolutely right. And the premise is if the data was there, it's probably 2 or 3 clicks to get the report that they want. So the issue is not getting them the report. It's having to redo some of the work to be able to output the report.
Well, and I would add the issue is not whether it's 2 or 3 clicks or it's not whether it is already in there or not. The real issue is number one, this was not in the original value that we agreed to deliver. So therefore, it is additional value. What I want to do at that point is I want to go, okay, well, what type of value is this going to create to the customer? Is it marginal value or is it major value? That's the first thing. Because if it's marginal value and you know what, it's 2 or 3 clicks, heck, just do it. It's one of those gifts, right? If it's major value, well, then we should be compensated for helping create that value. Now, why did this value come up? Is it something that the customer assumed was already there? Was there a mistake in communication? Did we make a mistake in discovery? Did the customer not share everything or reveal everything? We kind of need to, you know, explore that and have that. But again, what type of value is it going to create? Because ultimately, the effort to do it is to the customer, it doesn't matter. Because all the customer wants is a result. Now, who does the, quote, effort matter to? Well, it matters to you, the professional. And that's why I think you were bringing up the idea of 2 clicks versus, you know, going back and redoing some data entry. So why does effort matter to us? Because ultimately, effort translates into cost, which will affect our profit. Well, when do we consider costs as part of an engagement? Well, when you're approaching them from a value perspective, you first determine the value that the customer is seeking. You then determine a price that the customer would be willing to pay and that you would be willing to accept. By the way, value is really more in the customer's perception. Price, I think, is more in the professional's perception, although the customer has to agree that that's a fair price for that value. But for price, it's not just the customer accepts the price, the professional is willing to accept the price. And I think part of the problem sometimes that professionals get into and where scope creep gets into it is because they really underpriced it. They thought they needed the work or they thought they had to have the customer or whatever. They gave a concession they really shouldn't have given up. They just didn't have enough courage to stand their ground. But assume it's you know what the value is, it's a price you're both willing to accept. Well, then you look at your costs. You go, okay, can I deliver that value at this price and make a profit. And so when a change comes up, the first thing I look at is what's the additional value. If it creates significant additional value, I want to price that because it's outside the scope of value that we had in the agreement. Therefore, because it's outside the scope of value, it's going to create additional scope of work, which means there's probably additional cost attached to it. And number one, that we didn't agree to create that value. Number two, it's additional scope that we didn't agree I was going to deliver. Number three, it adds additional cost that's going to affect my profit. So for all three of those reasons, I want to write a change request and give the customer the opportunity to approve or reject that and pay the additional price. And I just lost my train of thought.
No, that's good.
I was just working up to something. I'm trying to remember what it was. Help me out a little bit. Where was I going with that?
All right. Well, the premise of what you were saying is look, we are supposed to, as professionals, we are supposed to be one step ahead of the client in terms of bringing this up originally. That way we can understand that they value it, which means that they will most likely ask for it, right? So if we are not proactively asking, you know, what is valuable to you, we are going to be completely surprised about the request they're going to have along the way. If we take their assumption of what they need when they came to you and say, I want you to do my bookkeeping, you make the assumption that whatever bookkeeping means to them is what means to you. And you're trying to just win the deal and try to give them the best possible price. We move forward and we talk nothing about what's valuable to them. Now, this concept of getting cost by project or cost by segment, it could be something that even during the conversation, they may not tell you if it's valuable to them, because maybe they're thinking that by saying yes, you're going to increase the price. And that could also be some of the psychological effects of the negotiation stage. But if you're not explicitly adding it as an option and saying, hey, you know, this is the price that I will give you with what we call, let's say, core bookkeeping. And this is the additional fee that it would be for us to proactively grab that extra information, right? Whether it's cost by segment, in the QuickBooks world, we call that class, or expenses by job, right? Cost by job. We don't proactively are asking for that information and recording it. We will never be able to give you that output, which means we have to explicitly exclude it from our engagement letter or a fixed price agreement or a scope document, whatever you want to call it. But you know, sometimes we make that mistake and we don't ask up front. So if we are not discovering what's valuable to them, we will never guess what is it that they're going to ask for later on. So that's the issue with clerking clients' requests. And this happens all the time, especially during tax season. We clerk the tax return. It happens all, I do it all the time. You know, in the interest of time, the client is giving us limited information that is good enough to push the return through. And if I didn't take the time to understand what was valuable to them, surprises come along the way, and they have come along the way. It is something that, it's just something that I deal with and I've dealt with and I'm getting better at. But I think what you were getting to, Kirk, is when this does happen, when the client tells you, hey, I was expecting this, or I didn't get that, that is probably one of the best lessons that you've gotten in business. That's consider that to be a gift to you as a professional. The client has just taught you that you either didn't listen, didn't ask, and you're not proactive. You weren't proactive enough to detect this. So every experience of a scope creep needs to be arsenal for you to be more proactive on the next job and ask those questions and discover them. And even if the client is in an industry that you would think they would never ask for that, you now have to add it to your repertoire. And if you don't specialize in an industry, then you're going to be asking a lot more questions, because you know the scope will get broader and broader. But as you specialize, micro-specialize, and become narrow expert in one particular industry or one particular type of client, then the amount of questions you need to ask to arrive to 95% of the request gets cut in a very small amount. So you can actually maximize that conversation, assuming that we all have a limited budget of 1 hour value conversation per client. right? So I think that's an important piece. So you nailed it on the head. If we don't know the client values it, there's absolutely no way we can offer a solution around it, which means that we're always going to be surprised by it.
So essentially what you're saying is you need to have a really good value conversation up front. I wonder where I've heard that before. So I want to get in, I want to go back to the example because you know, you basically said, let's make the wish list practical. And I want to do that. And as I was listening to you kind of unpack that, I guess now I got a better idea of how I would handle that. And sometimes I'm just going to say, just as I did in this conversation, when you first threw it out to me, I said, well, here's, you know, it's not just a new report, it's a new report, but there's data missing. And, you know, we should have scoped that up front and all that. But the bottom line is these situations are going to come up where, you know, it's an important change. It is valuable to the customer. How do you handle that? And so I want to go back and do it. And the first thing I would say is step back. Don't feel like you have to respond to it. And so the first response may be to the customer simply, hey, go ahead and describe for me, you know, what does that look like? Okay. I need to think about this. I'm not sure if it's in scope or out of scope, and I need to go back and look at it. It is okay to say, I can't give you an answer right now. I need to research it. I need to think about it. It may just be that you're going to get up and go to the gym tomorrow morning, and after, you know, you go to the gym and the endorphins kick in, you're going to have an idea of how you want to handle it. But for this specific situation, I think we can determine based on the example you gave, it's out of scope, right? And so what we have to say to the customer is, look, this is out of scope. I'd be happy to help you with this. However, I'm going to need to write a change request. Now, if you have communicated to the customer initially as part of your sales process that, hey, we give you a fixed price for a fixed scope of work. And by the way, if there's a change in scope, we'll write a change request with a new scope and a new price. By the way, that language is in our proposal for software projects. It's in there. There's no way they can't see it, because when we present the proposal, we go over it. I mean, I literally read it almost word for word. So they've heard it. So I'm repeating it. So I've educated them. So they may not be consciously expecting it, but subconsciously, when I bring it up, it should go, oh yeah, they mentioned this. So what I say is, let me put together a change request. By the way, you can't put together a change request until you've had a value conversation with a customer about that new change, okay? So you've got to understand the value. And typically, in understanding the value, you'll begin to, you know, formulate what scope might go with that. But by the way, you can offer options on the change, right? So for example, and that's kind of where I was going with this after I kind of had that aha moment. Number one, okay, well, one option is, who's going to enter that data, right? Is the customer going to enter that data and then you'll create the report? Are you going to enter that data and then you'll create the report? Is there another report that already exists? Is there a default report in QuickBooks that even if they enter that data would get them part of the way there? You see where I'm going with this? So maybe option one is, hey, we're just going to take advantage. You know, if you enter the data, you'll be able to take advantage of this built-in report. We won't have to do anything except, you know, maybe there's a little bit of training or something you'll have to do. But anyway, it's a low cost option, puts most of the effort, quote unquote, onto the customer. They get that value, but they get it at a lower price. Middle option is, they enter the data, you create the report. Top option is, you enter the data, they create the report. All of that kind of thing. And here's what's interesting. I think by default, we assume that if there is a discussion about a change request, that's going to be adversarial. I have not found that to be true. I have actually found that when I state the process, and by the way, it all goes together. You can't just take the concept of a change request and throw it in with hourly billing and expect it to work. When I talk about the concept of a change request, it's within the business model of value pricing. But when you do that, customers just expect it. It's almost that they may not like it, but they respect you because as the professional, you said, I have a process and now I'm following the process. When the opportunity for conflict comes up is number one, when there is no process. And by the way, hourly billing, this is part of the problem because it's not a process. Okay. It's just math, and it's bad math at that. I don't mean bad math in the sense it's inaccurate, but bad math in that, you know, just because 2 + 2 × 4 doesn't mean that getting 4 is something that's valuable to the customer. I'm getting a little bit off track. But anyway, bottom line is, when you have a set process and you follow that process, and the process fits with the business model, it actually, the customer respects you more because you told them what you were going to do and then you did it.
And as you're saying that, I had my own sort of aha moment within your aha moment. And we're probably going to go over an hour a little bit, but that's okay.
We're so, having concentric aha moments.
Exactly. The dual aha moment. So I was just thinking about what you're saying. You know, if you can come up with a change request in which there's always a free option, right? You could always design a free option about around it. Then it's always, well, what's the difference between adversarial? What's the opposite of adversarial? Collaborative, let's call it that.
There you go.
Yeah, so it's not going to be always adversarial if one of the options is, okay, great, Mr. Customer, these are the three options that we have. This one, here's the path for you to do it on your own. Here's the path for us to do it together. Here's the path for me to just take care of it. And you price it. And by doing that, I believe that if you always give the client that free option, it's almost like you're just being a guide and helping them. And also you're taking that work off the table. And you can always at the end achieve the same result as long as the client has decided that they are going to take over that piece. Right. One of the typical, and now that I'm thinking about it, of course, that makes total sense. One of the typical things that happened to me on my bookkeeping jobs is that after we're done with the bookkeeping, the client says, oh, you didn't scan all the receipts and attach them to the transactions? Kirk, I don't know if you do this type of work, but you know, the difference between doing bookkeeping and doing bookkeeping plus attaching receipts, it's a tenfold difference. I mean, it's not even like a little bit more. It's the amount of work around having to isolate every single document to a transaction versus just downloading it from the bank and categorizing them. It's monumental. So when the client comes back and says, okay, here's the options. One, here's the tools for you to upload every receipt on your own. Here's the report that gives you the database so you can select each one and upload. Two, you know, maybe I can upload some of the most important ones, you know, receipts over 5,000, over 100, whatever it happens to be. And or three, you know, just give us your shoebox and we'll take care of the whole thing. And then you price the three, the zero option, the middle option, and the higher option. So that was my first aha moment. The other aha moment I had, again, this is not only concentric aha moments, these are double and triple aha moments. Diane Mueller from our Facebook group sent a comment that says, you know, what if you take monthly bookkeeping off the table? So I was trying to understand that. What the heck is she trying to say? I think what she's trying to say is instead of, you know, pricing the bookkeeping, you know, bookkeeping is implied, but you price the results. So when you have an engagement, which is financial results engagement, not a bookkeeping engagement, the bookkeeping itself comes off the table. And then you're no longer thinking about bookkeeping as the service. You're thinking about that report at the end as a service. So when you concentrate on that end result, you're going to be much more likely to actually have those discussions around, you know, what is it that they want instead of how is it that we want us to do the work or what in essence is what the client thinks is the work that we're doing. So I think that's a great way of doing it. Just like, you know, we don't do bookkeeping. We provide financial reports and there's a couple options. The one that gives you client information, the one that doesn't give you client information. The one that gives you segment information, the one that doesn't. And I think that she had, I just think that's very insightful because that is at the end what changes your mindset to be talking about the result, not talking about the actual work that you do. Now, Kirk, this is probably going to be a good topic for the next episode. So, but I'm going to throw it out there. I'm thinking about the wish list. I'm still thinking about the wish list and I'm trying to figure out how we can implement it in our practice. But what if there was some system where we do reverse scoping? Whereas instead of scoping, we just had the client write down all the things that they fantasize that an accounting system and an accounting engagement can do for them, right? And they start writing it down, you know, a report of this type, making more money, increasing my cash flow, better reports, faster report, less time. Just have clients just write this humongous wish list and maybe not even write it down, put them on little like index cards or something. And then once you have it all out there of all the possible things you can do, then you grab them and you put them together into a service. And then if the client has a limited budget, which I think is one of the most common things, you figure out what that budget is and say, okay, let's do this. With your budget, we can do this. And then you actually pick out the items from the wish list and put them in the bucket of that budget. Or maybe you can figure out their budget range and then saying all in reverse, you pick the three buckets. Let's say the budget range is to just get, say, a number, 500 to 1500. So you create three buckets, 500, 1000, and 1500. And then you grab the wish list and then you insert in each bucket from that wish list what would fit at that price range. What do you think about something like that? Again, I'm trying to figure out how to get the wish list into the accounting profession. I think it's a cool, really cool concept.
You know, it's interesting. I think we have overcomplicated, or maybe I've overcomplicated, this idea of a wish list. It's simply a shopping list. Think of it like a shopping list. What do you do when you're going to go grocery shopping? And I thought of this because literally, you know, I'm going grocery shopping this afternoon. And so this morning I was asking my wife, where's the shopping list? Well, every time you think you need something or you think of something new, you write it on the list. Well, what do you do when you go shopping? Well, you and if you're on a budget especially, well, you, and I guess everybody should be on a budget, right? But anyway, you prioritize those things, right? If you have limited budget, you're going to prioritize and buy the most important things. So some of the things may not get bought. You may have to wait till the next shopping trip, or you may have other reasons. There's a coupon coming out, or, you know, you don't need that kind of food in the house. You don't want your kids to eat that. Maybe there's an allergy or whatever. You know, you're thinking about it. You're making those decisions. That's my point. That's all a wish list is. It's simply a shopping list for the customer, but we don't want to call it a shopping list because, my goodness, that sounds horrible. But by calling it a wish list, a wish is the idea that, you know, here's something that could happen or that might need to happen. We're not even going to, when you say, let's just put this on the wish list, you're able to delay the value conversation. You're able to delay a conversation about, is this even something we need to do? Is this solving the right problem? Is this the right way to solve the problem? Is this marginal value? Is it, you know, substantial value? Et cetera, et cetera. How would this affect existing processes? I mean, I can just come up with all kinds of things that you want to consider. And when you stop in the middle of a project to consider those things, it's going to slow you down. And so it's just such a great tool, not because we want to delay those conversations for the sake of delaying, but we want to delay them for, number one, we don't want to have to do a change request if it's not necessary. And two, it provides a way so that a customer doesn't think you're going to forget things, right? I mean, the wish list for us, we use Basecamp, and we literally set up a to-do list in Basecamp. The title of it is wish list. And with my existing customers, they're very comfortable with the vocabulary of, hey, we can't do that right now, but I'm going to add it to the wish list. Or sometimes I'll go, I can't do that right now. Do you want me to add it to the wish list? And most of the time, what's their response? Yes.
Yeah, maybe the wish list is not even part of the scope. The wish list is just a way, like just like we, how do we get our, so this is a, and we're probably over time here because we're supposed to stay within an hour, but whenever we buy things for our kids for the holidays, you know, we get them to, when they were younger, they wrote a letter to Santa or whatever, but we get them to write down the wish list and they don't get it all. But I think it gives us a good general idea of what they want or the themes around what they want. And we as parents, sometimes we obey by the wish list. Sometimes we get them some things from the wish list. Sometimes we look at items in the wishes and say, you know what? I want him to have something like that, but maybe something that is not as, I don't know, violent or for older people or, you know what I mean? So we use the wish list contextually, sometimes to fulfill the whole thing, part of it, or to maybe know for the next year or 2 years what they want. So I think there's something to this whole wish list concept. And again, you're right. We're overcomplicating it. And mostly because Kirk and I, just so you know, the way we prepare for these shows is we text each other. It's like, we're doing scope. Yes, that's it. that's how we prepare for the show. And a lot of these things, you know, we are sort of like brainstorming on the spot. And a lot of things Kirk is saying, it just makes my brain think in a different direction and vice versa. So we're just having a basically open conversation about our initial perception of the questions. And that's where we go off tangents like this, just because we're sort of thinking and talking at the same time. So I don't think, Kirk, we should bucket or put away the wish list idea. I think there's something to it. So we may want to explore that later on.
Oh, I'm not suggesting we put it away at all. I'm simply saying we're overcomplicating it. It's a shopping list. It's a future shopping list for the customer. And it's a great tool to help the customer accept that we're not going to do something right now so we can stay focused on the current result that we have agreed to achieve.
That's right. Well, I guess that's a good stopping point for us. And Kirk, thank you very much for introducing a new concept that's just not going to let me sleep for a whole week. And I'll see you next. See you next week.
Hector, I think what you're experiencing is what our colleagues call a Verisage headache.
Yes, pretty much.
All right. See you next week.
See you next week.